The headlines. Yemenis rally in the northern city of Sada to condemn the UN for turning a blind eye to the massacre of Yemeni children by Saudi Arabia. Iran rejects a statement by the U.S. and France about the JCPOA, saying that it is up to Washington to make the decision on reviving the deal. And the World Health Organization says the shortage of coronavirus vaccines in low-income countries, especially in Africa, is a global failure. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. Yemenis have staged a demonstration in the province of Sada to condemn the UN for its inaction to the violation of their rights, including those of children. Protesters also expressed their anger towards the recent UN decision to include Yemen's Ansar Allah movement in its blacklist of parties violating children's rights. The resistance movement itself had earlier denounced the measure by calling it disgraceful, unjust, and far from realities. It accused the world body of turning a blind eye to the massacre of Yemeni children by Saudi Arabia over the past years. Since Riyadh launched its devastating military campaign against Yemen in 2015, thousands of children have been killed or displaced. Yemeni officials say that more than 2.6 million Yemeni children also suffer from malnutrition, and hundreds of them are in urgent need of medical treatment abroad. John Stepling is an author and commentator joining us. John Stepling, you have, of course, on the one side how the UN is in some sense ignoring what Saudi Arabia has done and putting the Ansar Allah movement on this list, this blacklist. But I think there's another story to this, and that is how just recently the media, the U.S., has ramped up its pressure on the Ansar Allah movement, in particular when they started making gains on the ground in this province, Ma'arib, which holds oil. And I think that has something to do with it, but then again, you're the analyst. Maybe you could fill us in on it.
Well, no, I think you're right. Look, the Saudi orchestrated and led assault on Yemen, of course, that had British and American assistance from the beginning. That assault did not go as planned. It didn't go as planned from day one. And it has been an embarrassment for bin Salman. The Saudi fighters were inept. They were targeting hospitals, water purification plants, schools, etc. And so the humanitarian catastrophe became just enormous, almost unimaginable. And civilians were targeted, and thousands of children have been killed. Now, the UN never speaks in one voice, really, anyway, and that should be borne in mind. But they do a lot of hand-wringing and whatnot. But when it comes to official declarations, they are never going to cross the U.S. The UN, at the end of the day, is an organ of the U.S. propaganda machine, and it has no real teeth to any of the resolutions it passes. You can also compare the hypocrisy in all this, because we know the Israeli assault on Gaza recently killed I don't know how many dozens of children, and the UN was largely silent. Western media really was in many ways largely silent. There were a few token objections, but the basic premise, the basic narrative, which is that Iran is a rogue state, the Saudis are friends of progress and are in the midst of wholesale reform, modernization. Israel is the only democracy in the region and a friend of the West. That's the narrative. And Iran is always demonized as somehow, for some reason, a rogue state and a force of destabilization. Now, we know the U.S. and Israel want a coup in Iran. They've wanted that for a long time. And there's economic reasons for that and so forth, which are all well known. And we know the story of the JCPOA as well, and the sanctions. Now, you know, if you add all of this up, you might wonder if any of the pronouncements coming from the West, from the U.S., the U.N., NATO, if any of these bear any relationship to reality at this point? And the answer is no, they don't. And then on top of it, as you pointed out, the Houthis, the resistance won the war for all intents and purposes, much as in a certain sense Hamas won recently in Gaza. These acts of aggression by Israel or by the Saudis and by extension the United States have not gone as planned. They've not been successful. And the people that make money, the defense industry, don't care, but the wonks in Washington and the think tanks are scrambling to figure out what to do next, I think, because it's been a disaster. It's been a PR disaster, and of course it's been a just, as I say, unimaginable humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. A whole generation has had their future wiped out. The country is in ruins. It's been demolished. And millions of people displaced, literally. So it speaks to the ugliness of the Saudi regime, the cruelty, the sadism, and depravity of people like Mohammed bin Salman, who we know is a psychopathic murderer. We know that. But you don't read that in the Western press, unfortunately.
Thank you very much, John Stepling, author and commentator there from Interboy. Moving on, Tehran says it will return to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal only after the U.S. removes its sanctions on Iran in a verifiable manner. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said that Iran has unilaterally held the agreement alive since the U.S. left the agreement, and the European sides to the deal could not live up to their commitments. Saeed Khatibzadeh said it is the U.S., not Iran, which must make the decision on returning to the deal by removing its illegal sanctions. The remarks come after the U.S. and France said that it was up to Iran to take the final difficult decisions to revive the deal. Khatibzadeh said that Washington's complete noncompliance with the JCPOA has, in effect, impeded the implementation of the deal. Political commentator Jan Oberg says that the European sides to the Iran nuclear deal failed to create an alternative to offset U.S. sanctions. He says that instead of repeating the U.S. narrative, they should put pressure on Washington to rejoin the deal.
The European Union and the countries in Europe behind the JCPOA have not been able to create an alternative to the U.S. and its secondary sanctions and other things. And I'm not surprised that if, you know, there's a kind of convenience in saying these things about Iran at the moment. You should do this, you should do that, you should do this, you should do that. But they themselves should put pressure long ago on the United States to behave itself and come back to the agreement according to international law. I mean, you hear this again and again, that we need to, that the U.S. Promotes a rules-based international order. It doesn't. It doesn't uphold international law. It doesn't respect UN Security Council resolutions by leaving. And it has only one thing to do, that is say, sorry, the former administration did something we definitely are not behind anymore. Let Biden show that he's different from Trump.
Hezbollah Secretary General Seyed Hassan Nasrallah has denounced the U.S. government's move to seize dozens of media websites. He said that the main reason behind the decision is the outlet's support for the Palestinian cause. Maryam Saleh has more from Beirut.
Hezbollah Secretary General Seyed Hassan Nasrallah began his televised speech by denouncing the U.S. administration's decision to seize and block dozens of website domains connected to Iranian and regional media outlets.
It's not coincidental that these websites which were seized are media outlets that had a major role in supporting the Palestinians in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. They all have a clear position from the Zionist enemy and the American hegemony over the region. These outlets are critical of sedition and terrorism, specifically Takfiri terrorism. This gives us and the free people of the world another piece of evidence against the false claims of the U.S. administration, which claims to defend freedom of speech and freedom of opinion.
Said Nasrallah also criticized U.S. statements that attempt to incite the Lebanese army against the resistance. Said Nasrallah noted that U.S. officials have tried to justify their humble support to the Lebanese army by stressing that this assistance is aimed at giving the army leverage to confront Hezbollah. This, Said Nasrallah says, will not happen since the National Army is the main guarantor for peace in the country. On another note, the resistance leader explained how Hezbollah has been exerting an effort to mediate talks for the formation of the cabinet.
All efforts in the country must come together to form a government and to pull the country out of this dilemma. Since Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri was named by most members of parliament, we have been working on a quick formation of the cabinet. We have been supportive of an initiative from Speaker Barry, and we will work on finding resolutions to the last few disagreements in the talks.
Experts believe Syed Nasrallah's words and sufferings of the people lining up at gas stations and pharmacies should be an incentive for the officials to find solutions.
Syed Nasrallah said there is no magical solution, and he stressed that the crisis should be disintegrated and resolved one by one until the government is reestablished. If we want to go back to the state where the government collects taxes and the citizens practice their rights and responsibilities in paying taxes, where there are investments in the country again and we create more job opportunities, all of these issues need political stability. And political stability will be the only first step to genuinely solve the many crises in the country.
Syed Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah has accomplished all the administrative and logistic preparations for importing gasoline and fuel from Iran to Lebanon in case the state fails to cover the fuel shortage. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The World Health Organization has criticized the shortage of coronavirus vaccines in the poor countries, calling it a global failure.
The world, as international community, as the world is failing. As global community, we are failing. The problem is vaccine supply. And even now, it's not the absorptive or the delivery problem that's a problem. There is no vaccine.
The WHO chief said the vaccination situation in many low-income countries, especially in Africa, is worrisome. He said that while less than 2% of the population is vaccinated in these countries, the infections are surging by 50% on the weekly basis. He also raised concern about the Delta variant that first emerged in India and its rapid spread among unvaccinated populations. He also said the only way to prevent the emergence of new variants is to thwart further transmission of the virus. He warned that otherwise new variants will continue to emerge. Australia's largest city is set to enter a two-week lockdown amid the outbreak of a highly infectious variant of COVID-19. The curbs will affect Sydney, the state capital of New South Wales, and some surrounding areas as of Saturday. Under the new rules, people can leave home for essential work, medical care, education, or shopping. Public gatherings will be banned in the rest of the state, and masks will be obligatory indoors. The state premier says that restrictions will be eased if cases decrease in 7 days.
If we're going to do this, we need to do it properly. There's no point doing a three-day lockdown and then having the virus continue to bubble away in the community. Now, if after 7 days there's a dramatic change in the trend, well, obviously, we will evaluate the situation. But at this stage, the best health advice we have is that a two-week period or until midnight the Friday, the 9th of July, is necessary in order to make sure we get to our target of zero community transmission, which has always been our target from the beginning of the pandemic.
Australia has so far reported more than 30,000 cases and just over 900 deaths since the start of the pandemic. But the fast-spreading outbreak of the Delta variant of the virus in Sydney has raised concerns. The head of Afghanistan's Peace Council has called for continuation of long-stalled talks on a political settlement with Taliban militants, despite their surging attacks.
I think we shouldn't shut the doors unless it's completely shut by the Taliban. Today also, we cannot say no to talks, in spite of lack of progress in negotiations or in spite of what's happening on the ground. Because eventually, the last man killed will not be a solution. There has to be a peaceful settlement.
Abdullah said an absolute majority of the Afghan people wants an inclusive, peaceful settlement. He said the people cannot continue fighting forever because that is not the solution. Abdullah spoke after he and President Ashraf Ghani met with the U.S. President Joe Biden at the White House. Last week, the Taliban said that they are committed to peace talks, but their rising violence and seizure of several areas in the northern part of the country have raised fears about the prospect of an ongoing dialogue in Qatar. New developments come ahead of the planned withdrawal of U.S. troops on September 11th. Meanwhile, the Taliban have said that they have the right to react if the U.S. keeps its troops on the Afghan soil after a deadline for its military withdrawal. The Taliban spokesman told Al Jazeera News that keeping the troops in the country would be a clear violation of the 2020 Doha Agreement with Washington. Comments come after U.S. officials said that about 650 American troops are expected to stay in the country past the September 11th deadline to provide security for the country's diplomats. Ramin Alami says the Taliban have already intensified attacks in Afghanistan despite the Doha peace agreements.
The Taliban has always named not only the U.S. but all foreign troops as occupation forces and have repeatedly stressed that we will continue our fight against these forces. But let's not forget that this is not only the U.S. forces or other foreign troops that are being targeted by the Taliban militants since the oust of the Taliban regime back in 2001. Thousands of Afghan civilians have also been killed as a result of rising violence in this country, mainly due to expansion of Taliban attacks.
Pakistan's self-exiled former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is in hot water after High Court set aside his appeal to acquit his 10-year jail term. Sharif has been staying in London for nearly 2 years to avert imprisonment on money laundering charges. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
On April 26, 1986, the worst nuclear accident in history occurred when a reactor exploded at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine, releasing 90 times the radioactivity of the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As whole towns were evacuated in a matter of hours, the radiation left a devastating trail everywhere it touched. In hospitals, schools, playgrounds, entire villages, and the life of every single person present in the town on that day. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Now, 3 decades after the accident, Chernobyl, the once devastated ghost town, has become a tourist destination with its own thriving cafe. With the passage of time and despite the dangerously high levels of radiation, the fears of the older generations have been replaced by the fascination of the new. Popularized in video games and horror movies, the Chernobyl nuclear reactor is now an attraction for travelers from all over the world, and tourism agencies are thriving. This week on Aperture, we will go to Chernobyl to see how life is finding its way back to the town. Stay with us.
Thank you. 26th of April, 1986, at approximately 1:24 a.m., reactor number 4 of the Chernobyl nuclear plant starts melting.
Мы впервые реально столкнулись с такой грозной силой, какой является ядерная энергия, вышедшая из-под контроля.
A significant amount of radioactive material is projected for several days in the air, affecting all forms of life in a radius of 500 kilometers around the plant.
299 человек госпитализированы с диагнозом лучевой болезни разной степени тяжести.
Tens of thousands of liquidators clean up radioactive waste that is scattered at the site and the surrounding areas just after the explosion. Their protections are insignificant, and they are exposed to doses of lethal radiation. Most of them will die or end up disabled.
Выражаю глубокое сочувствие семьям, родственникам погибших, трудовым коллективам, всем, кто пострадал от этой беды, кого постигло личное горе.
An area of 30 kilometers around the plant is closed and totally drained of its 115,000 inhabitants. Chernobyl is and will remain radioactive for thousands of years. Years after the disaster, what is it that drives man to come back to this contaminated land? At about an hour and a half drive from Kiev, the checkpoint Dityatki marks the entrance into the 30-kilometer forbidden zone. Access is strictly regulated, and the army controls every entrance and exit. At first glance, we see that nature is very present. In 1986, Chernobyl City had about 1,300 inhabitants, and officially today, there are none. Despite all this, grass is mowed and houses are maintained. And you quickly forget where you are. But the devil is in the details. All is calm, almost frozen, yet there are signs of life, attempts to make daily life more colorful and joyful. In fact, about 600 people live and sleep here in Chernobyl. Most of them are working on the building of the new sarcophagus that will soon cover the plant. They're allowed to stay for 15 days in the area, but then they must leave for the next 15 days. This is the rule in order to not exceed the radiation dose. The new water pipes were not buried in order to avoid contact with the radioactive ground. So the pipes are apparent. Sometimes you have to step over them, and sometimes they're the ones that cross over you. All of a sudden, at certain hours, life starts up again. Cars go by. People walk home or ride their bikes. Here, combat clothes are the fashion. It's as if everyone was at war against the invisible enemy. Radioactivity in the city is near to normal. In subdivisions, homes were abandoned immediately after the disaster. People left everything. Some people have returned and have put their homes back in order. They furnish them and they live there, but they still follow the rule of 15 days in the area, 15 days out. In these neighborhoods, life is modest. And for a few hundred euros, you can buy a small house with a garden and enjoy the tranquility of a true country house. A small community coexists, and social life is slowly growing. In 2013, a cafe opened in the heart of the city of Chernobyl. Before 1986, these premises housed a large municipal canteen. The establishment was called Canteen Number 10, and the cafe was christened Cafe 10. Coincidence or destiny, it's 10 kilometers from the plant. It is open from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., and every day, 30-some people have a drink or eat Ukrainian specialties on the menu. Several devices continuously measure radioactivity. The cafe also offers rooms worthy of a good hotel in Kiev. Sergei, the boss, made a bargain when he settled here. The cafe employs 10 people. They're all aware of the risks and have thought long and hard before coming to work here. More and more tourists come eat in the cafe. They rub shoulders with the plant workers. Noon is the rush hour. The time in the zone being limited, service must be fast and efficient. Everyone releases stress and anxiety. Coming to Chernobyl is far from trivial. The cafe even has its gift shop. In the afternoon, the tourists leave Chernobyl and hit the road to the city of Pripyat. Fresh out of Chernobyl, we must go through a new military checkpoint. We enter the 10-kilometer zone around the plant. The Red Forest, this is the name given to the 400 hectares of pines that once surrounded the plant. After the accident, the trees turned red because of the radioactive radiations. The whole forest was bulldozed and buried. Today, the new arch construction is visible from afar. It will replace the old sarcophagus, and it will entirely cover the plant. The radioactivity here is alarming. In the inside of a car, it is 50 times above normal. You do not stop. Doses are much higher on the ground. A few kilometers further north, the road splits into two. A monument points to the one that leads to the city of Pripyat. One must cross the Bridge of Death. The day after the disaster, the inhabitants of the city gathered here to watch the plant burning. On this bridge, they all received lethal doses of radiation. On April 27th, 1986, at dawn, the city of Pripyat was still asleep. The white flashes visible in these images are due to radiation. The plant's been burning for over 20 hours now, and the population still doesn't know what's going on. The military rushed here, crossed by the first early risers of the population. But nothing is said. It's Sunday. People go out. 3 kilometers away, helicopters hover above reactor number 4. They try to extinguish the flames and limit releases of iodine, cesium, and tellurium that spread continuously in the air. Every hour, the army measures radioactivity around the city. The counters are panicking. At this rate, the lethal dose is reached within 4 days. Precisely 49,360 people live here. In a few hours, the lives of these people will be shattered. 1,200 buses and 200 trucks will arrive in the main square. It'll only take 3.5 hours to empty the city. The loudspeakers make the announcement. One may only take bare necessities, identification papers, change of clothing, and some food for the trip. It is forbidden to take animals. The voice on the loudspeaker says that this is a temporary evacuation. The first buses enter the city early in the afternoon. People leave their apartments and entrances of buildings are locked behind them. Some faint and others vomit. Most of them are already heavily irradiated. By late afternoon, the city's deserted. The families will be rehoused in social apartments in Kiev. They will be rejected and abused. No one wants to live near contaminated neighbors. Those that left for 3 days would in fact never return. Pripyat is now completely surrounded by barbed wire, and access to the city is guarded by one man. Pripyat is now populated with trees. They grow everywhere. Most plants have adapted, and their DNA has mutated. They have many structural defects, tumors and malformations. It's not spectacular, but degeneration has become the norm. The land is less contaminated in the area, because each year, radionuclides sink deeper into the ground. However, these plants absorb radioactive particles by their roots, which then grow to the surface. Moss, leaves, and flowers are contaminants. The Pripyat swimming pool has become one of the most visited places in the city since it appeared in a famous video game. Some come from far away just to see it for real. Built to accommodate the families of those who worked at the plant, the town provided everything one could wish for at the time. Right next to the pool were the trace of an old courtyard of one of the five schools. 1,000 students studied here. On the ground floor, the canteen is strangely empty. Even the heavy cast iron radiators are gone. Looters came and took everything that was valuable. A little further, hundreds of children's gas masks litter the ground. Each school had its own stock in anticipation of a possible U.S. nuclear attack. In reality, they were never used. The looters are the ones who threw them there. Time is frozen in the corridors. The patriotic newspaper of April 23rd is still on display. In some classrooms, it feels like the day after the disaster. Sometimes realism is a bit too forced and disturbing. Some objects seem to have been moved and staged for tourists' photographs. The city has the most contaminated spots in the whole area, yet it attracts more and more people. In the hospital, you can still find clothes left by the liquidators on the day of the disaster. This is one of the most radioactive places in the world, yet some visit it unprotected, risking exposure to lethal doses. The area is often compared to a nature reserve, thanks to the great diversity of flora and fauna that are present. Hunting and fishing are prohibited in the little port of Pripyat. The last moored boat has almost finished sinking. It's difficult to imagine that life once swarmed here. Hundreds of people came every weekend to go sailing or picnicking in this tavern at the water's edge. Serge Dityarenko has been a guide in the area for 5 years. His work is his passion, but he admits that being here is also a form of fighting defeat. The Ukrainian army is fighting to keep its land and border from Russia, whereas here we are in the process of taking back soil contaminated by the former USSR. An amusement park should have been opened 4 days after the disaster. Yet the Ferris wheel was started the day after the explosion to keep the locals busy and avoid panic before the evacuation. It became the symbol of the city. This is the inescapable cliché. The authorities and tour operators want reassurance regarding the doses of radiation that tourists are exposed to. But nobody knows the real impact of such visits on the body. So-called black or morbid tourism is on the rise. Travel agencies have seized this opportunity. There are more and more tourists, but the former inhabitants of the city rarely want to come back.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's tip, what are the secrets of Ubudiyah in the words of Imam Khomeini? now, dear listeners, it's great to have you with us on the program. We're talking about, of course, Ubudiya, a servitude of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. And it's very interesting, but I ran across some words of Imam Khomeini where he talks about Ubudiya. He says, Allah the Great is the ruler over the heavens and the earth, and men are to perform their duties, their obligations, and they are to bow in respect their heads before the divine will. If we pause for just a moment and try to reflect upon this statement of Imam Khomeini talking about Ubudiya, we find that first and foremost, Imam Khomeini, he glorifies and praises Allah. And so in our Ubudiya, dear friends, one of the things which helps us to increase our sincerity or increase our devotion, increase our feelings when we are doing the servitude of Allah, when we are in Ubudiya, is to realize that Allah is the greatest. Allah is the creator of everything. He has given existence to all that exists. He is the ruler over the heavens and the earth. This idea, dear brothers and sisters, where we start to realize who Allah is and what kind of attributes Allah has, this has a huge impact on our Ubudiya. Because, of course, how can we worship Allah if we have no knowledge of Allah? And so one of the steps to increase our Ubudiya, in the words of Imam Khomeini, is of course to understand and to know who Allah is. In the second part of his statement, he says that men are to perform their duties. This in itself is Ubudiya. The performance of our duties, of our obligations, our wajibat, those things that are obligatory upon us, and likewise to refrain from the things that are haram, the things that are prohibited to us, this is also, in essence, ubudiya. It is the worship and the servitude of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. And of course, the last thing that Imam Khomeini said in this sentence of his was that men, humankind, humanity must bow in respect their heads before the divine will of Allah. And so in our Ubudiya, dear friends, we bow in respect and in awe of the grandeur of Allah, the Majestic, the Mighty. Truly, these are beautiful words and a very interesting exposition of Ubudiya in the words of Imam Khomeini.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith who are listening to IRIB English Radio. Welcome to this segment of the program, Foresight. My name is Muhammad, and today I'd like to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatu Ta'ibin, the Whispered Prayer of the Repenters. Please stay with me. My God, let the cloud of your mercy cast its shadow upon my sins, and send the billow of your clemency flowing over my faults. My God, does the fugitive servant return to anyone other than his master? Or does anyone grant him sanctuary from his master's wrath other than his master himself? My God, if remorse for sins is a repentance, I by your might am one of the remorseful. praying forgiveness for offenses as an alleviation. I am one of those who pray forgiveness. To you I return, that you may be well pleased. My God, through your power over me, turn toward me. Through your clemency toward me, pardon me. And for your knowledge of me, be gentle toward me.
Welcome back, dear listeners, in continuation to what we were saying, which was how we can increase our ubudiyya and some of the secrets of ubudiyya in the words of Imam Khomeini. Now, when we talk about ubudiyya, of course, one of the things that we had read from this statement of Imam Khomeini was to understand and try to realize to the best of our capability who Allah is. And one of the ways to know Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, Glorified, and Blessed is He, is to know His qualities, to know His attributes. And so, of course, once we know and we start to realize and understand and fathom to whatever extent we can the attributes of Allah, we will become closer to our loving and nurturing Lord. And, of course, this will have a huge impact on our servitude of Allah, our ubudiyya. Now, Imam Khomeini also continues in this statement of his. He says that humanity is not to worship other than Allah, and humanity is not to put foot on any path except the path of Allah. As this world is just a transit station, it is temporary, it will soon pass by so quickly. While the permanent abode of the servants is in the neighborhood of Allah, the Glorified. Another key and another secret to the servitude of Allah, to the worship of Allah, and that is in our lives, dear brothers and sisters, we are not to worship anything other than Allah. Meaning, our desires should not pull us towards worldly idols. We must not fall for the trap of worshiping worldly idols. And idols, dear friends, are no longer of wood and stone. But they are desires and power and greed and perhaps even sports stars or music stars or actors. These have become the modern day idols of humanity. And so again, in order to increase our ubudiyya, in order to strengthen our ubudiyya, we must not worship anything or anyone other than Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, and we should walk the path which is the path of Allah, the path of righteousness and nobility, and we must always remember that this world, it is just a transit station. We are just here for a temporary time, for a short time. Life passes by so quickly, but the permanent abode, the hereafter, that is where we will live forever. With these things in mind, surely our worship of Allah, our servitude of Allah, our bowing and our prostration in front of Allah is truly in hands. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Nowhere anywhere, I mentioned it before, nowhere anywhere do we ever see a verse of the Quran, a hadith, let's say, of the Ahl al-Bayt, that talks about the fact that you will find serenity and sukoon inside of this world. Yes, you might find a little bit of comfort here and there. It's very possible. But overall, this is a dunya to kind of get through, get over. It's a test, an exam. It's over with. Let's move on to our actual existence, which, of course, is the hereafter. Okay? The faster we get, understand that every hardship that comes our way in this world is precisely the function of this dunya. Don't look for, I won't look for things in this world, the world that it won't give me. I'm not looking for, you know, itminan al-qalb. I'm not looking for the comforting of the heart. I'm not looking for all these things. Not in a depressing and gloomy way. But yes, okay, I know that I'm going to go through another hardship. I'm going to go through another struggle. And Allah knows that with every struggle you go through, the next one seems a little bit more bearable because you're now a little bit more tougher. Okay, that lessens the anxiety. At least it makes it bearable. I know why I'm going through this anxiety. I know the purpose of this stress right now. Sometimes when you know the purpose of the stress becomes bearable. When I don't know why it's here, what am I doing, where is this from, a sign of God, a sign from Shaitan, what's happening, can you please answer my question? That adds to the anxiety. We end up now making something bigger than it should be. Okay, that's point number one I want to make to you. Point number two is a second cause of our spiritual anxiety and stress is behind us. And I talk about this a lot. And the reason why I keep repeating myself in various communities is because I see it too many times. I see this defeatist attitude too many times. Either it's the fact that we think that my past is too horrible for me to move forward, or I don't even deal with my past, thinking that if I bury it, it won't come up or rear its ugly head later on in my life. No, sometimes it will. Right? Sometimes we have unresolved issues from our past with people that we've decided, oh, you know what, I'm just going to bury it and bury it and bury it, and it comes back every single time, more ferocious than the last, to the point where it ends up being a panic attack, ends up being an anxiety attack, ends up affecting our health, becomes psychosomatic, where our mental baggage now, or our past now, comes and haunts us in the physical way. We become sweaty. We can't breathe. Right? We hyperventilate. Our heart is racing. Right? We feel nauseous. We feel tingly. In the process now, we make ourselves worse. Because I don't want to go back there. I don't want to handle those things. I don't want to address it with my parents or my spouse or my siblings, let's say, for example. Who, you know, when I was getting older, when I was growing up, you know, I was teased. I was never accepted inside of my home. Wasn't raised properly. Wasn't given equal love from my parents. Right? I was always told by my teachers and my friends that I would amount to nothing. Right? I was this overweight, ugly kid in school, for example. I was, you know, et cetera. And the list goes on and on. And we think from, oh, that was high school. That was grade 8, grade 12, grade, you know, university. That was a long time ago. I'm over it. And all of a sudden, now this anxiety comes out of the blue. This stress comes out of the blue, and we have no idea where it comes from. I have no idea why there's tears flowing down my face. I have no idea why I'm shaking right now. I have no idea why my heart is racing out of the blue. All night, tossing and turning. My pillow is drenched with sweat. Why? No, I'm comfortable. My family's good. My marriage is good. I live in my house. I'm very peaceful. What is it? And when you get deep and deep and deep inside, you know that there are things that are unresolved inside of us.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio.